Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West, everyone. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along on a Thursday, the 13th day of March. Today, a couple of young folks involved in the literary arts doing quite well, thank you. Plus, a seasoned veteran within the same genre, Nick Butler, is here. Eau Claire hometown, always loved writing, and his first novel, Shotgun Love Songs, was officially released on Tuesday. It's been getting very nice reviews from some very big voices. Jim Oliver stops by to share his conversation with Mary Logue, who participates as herself and her pseudonym, with news about the latest from her keyboard. Plus, we have the president of Clowns of America International, Glenn Kohlberger, to set the record straight on the assumed endangered status of clowns. The illustrations of Eliza Wheeler are magical, and like the stories for children and young people, they can and do transport you to the world where imagination lives. Eliza Wheeler grew up in Solon Springs, Wisconsin, not too far south of Superior. She got her degree in art and design at UW-Stout, and then no culture shock here, she moved to Los Angeles. She now has become a respected, desirable illustrator of children's and young people's books. She has credits on Doll Bones, a book by best-selling author and co-creator of the Spiderwick Chronicles, Holly Black. The recently released children's book, The Grudge Keeper, by Maria Rockliffe, and a book for which Eliza is both author and illustrator, Miss Maple's Seeds. So, Eliza, you are finding success in California, but how is the rest of it going?
The thing we were so disappointed about was cheese curds. You can't get cheese curds in California.
Sounds like a song title to me.
Yeah, totally.
You can't get cheese curds in California. Talk about being able to fund your vocation. Just start a cheese factory.
Yeah, exactly. The big thing out here are food trucks. So we'll have to get some kind of cheese curd thing going.
Sure. I had a conversation with a poet the other day, Eliza, and we talked about technology and the exposure it provides. Mm-hmm. And then we expanded on the topic, admitting to almost anyone's ability to be the best they can without having to migrate to New York or Los Angeles. That must not be the case with you and your chosen vocation.
Hmm? When we moved out to Los Angeles, it was for my husband Adam to pursue directing and writing, and I didn't really think there was anything out here for me in terms of, you know, anything specific to my career. And I got my degree at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. Mm-hmm. In graphic design. My goal was just to kind of get a job out here and do what I could to help pay the rent. I kind of found children's book illustrating out here without, you know, the intention of coming out here to do that.
From where I sit, Eliza, you have the best of both worlds. You have the capacity to live as a successful, functioning adult. But then you have the ability to consistently think like and immerse yourself in the world of children or adolescents. Is that how it works?
I agree with that 100%. I think that's what makes my job the best job in the world. Yeah, I love it. I love being able to sort of reach back into all of my memories of being a kid and pull the inspiration of what I loved when I was a kid and being able to, you know, being able to do that now. It's really cool. It's really cool to be able to draw pictures about the things that I love and am drawn to. And then, mm-hmm. you know, now it's getting published. It's getting shared with people. You know, it's really cool.
Here's a question that follows that line of thinking. Are you an adult drawing things for children, or do you take yourself back to be one of them for a while?
Oh, absolutely. I take myself back.
Okay.
For sure. Yep. When I'm drawing something, I'm not thinking about, you know, what kids might be thinking about this, but I do definitely think about, I remember what I loved, and I remember what I resonated with, and
sure.
I think that, you know, that helps to give me some confidence that that kids will be into this.
Mm-hmm. Up until a year ago, as I alluded, you were mainly an illustrator of other people's words, and then you added author to your resume. Tell me about the transition, then talk about the differences. I mean, on the surface, it would seem much easier to illustrate your own words, but maybe not.
Yeah. It's a really good question. I kind of got started out, I built an illustration portfolio, and then I also, you know, was writing for my own stories on the side, and I made a connection at a conference with the art director for Penguin Books, and I sent in one of my stories to her, and that's how I got the book deal for Miss Maple Seeds. And, yeah, it is kind of a different, totally different project when it's yours or when you're illustrating it for somebody else. The writing, for me specifically, is sort of a slower, more grueling, mentally grueling process. And the illustration is sort of more physically hard work, you know, like long hours at the desk, bent over, and, you know, it's more sort of physical time that you put into it. And the writing, I don't know, it takes more effort. You get attached to your own stories in maybe a deeper way. But it's also really nice to sort of be handed a manuscript that's been beautifully written and polished already, and then to say, here's this beautiful writing, you know, now make this come alive visually. And so there's a little bit more ease, I think, that comes with illustrating somebody else's stories versus illustrating your own.
I can imagine if it's your own book, you have the story in mind, then you start illustrating. Can it happen that maybe as you do one or the other, it changes the other one? In other words, you say, all right, hey, I'm going to draw Miss Maple flying in her dandelion. Oh, wait, I should have her do this. And then you can change the story. Does that ever happen?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. And when I'm working on a story that I'm writing and illustrating, the whole thing, I'm kind of doing it back and forth. I don't do one first and then work on the other. And the reason that it works out that way is, especially with children's picture books, the words and the pictures need to both function in different ways in the story, and you don't want to be too redundant. You know, you don't want to say exactly what's being shown. You kind of, you know, have to decide what exactly you want to say and what you want to show, and have those both work together.
On the phone with us here on Spectrum West, it's Eliza Wheeler. She is an illustrator of children's books, also an author now, and she's in California. She's originally from Solon Springs, Wisconsin. How cool is that?
Thank you.
Yeah. How is the business out there? And the reason I asked this question is I was thinking to myself, okay, here's Eliza, and she's illustrating other people's books, and then all of a sudden, she's writing her own book. You know, if I was a children's author, I would say, she's such a good illustrator. Why is she infringing on my territory? So then I thought, what I should do is ask her if it's a very competitive business.
Publishing in general is, I think, an extremely competitive field, and that's no different in children's publishing.
Maybe even more so.
Maybe. Although I will say it's sort of a friendlier field. You know, you go to these children's book conferences, and everyone's so happy to be doing what they're doing. And definitely being an illustrator, it is common to be a writer-illustrator, illustrate books for others, but also illustrate your own stories.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's great to be working full-time in this field. Yeah. It's something I never thought was even an option for me. You know, I think as a kid, I have always been drawn to illustration. I've been drawing since I was, you know, since I can remember. But along the way, even, you know, through high school, developing those drawing skills, you know, my art teacher, my parents, and myself, I don't think any of us ever really thought that children's books was a career pursuit, you know. And And so I went to school for graphic design, but it just always came back to drawing for me. You know, I couldn't get used to having to do work on the computer. And so I always tried to squeeze drawing into every single project that I did. And so it's always felt like that natural choice for me. So finding the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators is how I first got into children's books. And they throw these conferences every year. I went to the first one out here in the summer of 2009. That was it. I knew this is what I had to do.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I read in some biographical materials you listing some of your strongest influences on your creativity, as things like wild Wisconsin seasons, canoeing, picking blueberries with grandma, digging through the snow. A lot of those you can't do in Southern California. Do you have to come home for inspiration, or have you found comparable scenarios there?
Definitely. We usually make it back to Wisconsin once or twice a year. Yeah, it's just, it's a huge influence. Nature in general, I think, gives me so much inspiration artistically, and that's where I find my connection mm-hmm. with myself, I think. We do live close to Griffith Park in Los Angeles, that's as close as I can get to inner city nature. But, you know, we go hiking weekly, and it's a really great spot.
Cool. So what's next for Eliza Wheeler? What do you have on the drawing board right now?
Oh, so right now I'm working on a picture book. This is an illustration project, so not a project that I've written. Mm-hmm. The author is actually a Wisconsin author. Her name is Pat Zeitlow Miller. The book is called Wherever You Go. It's great. I'm drawing animal characters for the first time, and that's a lot of fun. It's a totally animal world, a little bunny discovering all of the roads of the world.
Yeah, bunnies do that. You know,
yes, right. Not on bikes, typically, though. This one's on a bike.
Well, Wisconsin bunnies ride bikes. I don't know about California bunnies, but we do.
They do, huh? Yeah. I never saw that.
Yeah, they do. What? How long of a process is it from the day you get the manuscript until you send your first materials?
Every project schedule is a little bit different. Picture books, specifically, you know, because it's mostly artwork, usually between 6 months and a year is what I like to give myself. I'm learning that the more time that I give myself, the better the artwork. And for middle grade books or chapter books like Doll Bones, the project schedules are much shorter, maybe a few months.
Well, Eliza, it's been fun talking to you. I mean, I can hear the energy in your voice. I can hear that you love what you do, and I sense a continuing bright and even brighter future for you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Al, so much. I'm really honored to be asked.
There you go. Yet another young, spirited individual raised and educated in our West Wisconsin midst, Eliza Wheeler. We wish her all the best. And the same to Sam, her husband, involved in film production, who grew up in Ladysmith. This is Spectrum West.
Support for WPR comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, bringing Mayo Clinic care to communities throughout western Wisconsin. Dedicated to providing high-quality health care close to home. Details are at mayoclinichealthsystem.org.
We appreciate you being with us here on Spectrum West. I read somewhere and then heard on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me that there's a shortage of clowns in America. Since then, the prospect has harvested a great deal of publicity. Could it be so? Is the clown an endangered species? Well, to find out, we went to the clown commander-in-chief, the president of Clowns of America International, Glenn Kohlberger. He was on the phone with us from Florida.
There is no shortage of clowns in America. The reporter from the New York Daily News decided to make that her lead story, and I think if you want to talk about a shortage of clowns, you need to talk to her, because she's the only one who knows that there is one.
What prompts a person of that visibility to write a story about it? Maybe there's a shortage of places where clowns are needed. Are they needed less than before?
Not at all. What people have to understand is that clowns will be around forever. There are all types of clowns. You have hospital clowns, you have missionary clowns, you have disaster clowns, like Red Nose Response that goes in after a disaster to try to help the situation. You have rodeo clowns, you have birthday party clowns. There's all kinds of different segments of clowning.
As you were speaking, I was thinking, I wonder what the history of clowning is. I mean, does it go back to like court jesters, or what do you think?
I'm sure it goes back to court jesters, but I believe that it even goes back like to the Mayan ruins back in those days. There were clowns back there. They have found evidence of clowns back then.
Like many things that were prevalent years ago, Glenn, tell me how clowning has suffered at the hands of progress. And you brought up how people have changed the image a little bit, the greedy Hollywood types.
Well, the fact of the matter is if you go to any movie house, they're doing any type of horror type of story, there's usually a clown involved somehow in it. They take what's pretty and nice and turn it into something scary because it sells movies or sells what they're looking for, the scare factor or the twist factor. And that's not what clowning is about. Clowning comes directly from the heart.
We talked yesterday briefly about famous clowns, and I sort of jotted them down. Emmett Kelly, Bozo, Clarabelle was one of my favorites when I was a kid. Ronald McDonald is a clown. What's involved in being a clown? I mean, it's got to be a lot like stand-up comedians. They're all over the board as far as how they entertain. I mean, there are silent clowns, ones who squeeze a horn. It's not just the makeup that determines a clown, is it?
No, it comes from the heart, and it's like talking about food. There's all different types of food, and each one has a basis somewhere different from the other, but they all clowns start from the heart. It's got to be something that's in you to begin with to want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be the hospital clowning, whether it be the birthday party clown or any circus clown, anything, you need to have it first here in the heart, and that's where it grows from. You can teach skills, but you can't teach the heart of a clown.
I heard about, after I mentioned to somebody that I was going to be speaking with you, I heard about clown camps and how big they were at one time. In fact, a Wisconsin guy named Rich Snowberg is the guy who got that ball rolling. Now at least that one is no more. Do clowns still congregate for the betterment of their craft?
Absolutely. Clowns of America International runs a convention every year. There are places like Moose Camp. Priscilla Mooseberger, who is a former Ringling clown, who runs a camp every year. There's still a California clown camping. There's many places where education is taught, and that's what the big thing about clowning is. It's the education. It's not just let's put makeup on and run out and be a clown. It's you have to learn the steps of becoming a clown in order to develop that heart that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Are young people coming to you guys and saying, I want to be a clown?
There are many young people coming to us. What happens in, and it's, if you stop and think about it, it kind of makes sense, is your younger clowns will get developed and then end up getting married and have children. So things are put on pause for a while.
Sure.
And then come back to us after either the children leave the nest or do part-time clowning during that time. Mm-hmm. But the younger clowns are coming to us. It still happens. You know, I mean, if they wouldn't, we would disappear. But that's never going to happen because there's always someone that has a heart of a clown. It's just a matter of developing them.
What is the, describe to me the heart of a clown.
The heart of a clown, it means, my phone, sorry about that.
I love that.
The heart of a clown is an internal drive from deep within that makes you either want to get before a situation or get involved in a situation where you're sharing what we call the clown heart with other people.
Mm-hmm. On the phone with us from Florida, Glenn Kohlberger. He's the president of Clowns of America International. Is or was the prominent domain of clowns the circus?
If we go back far enough, yes.
Okay.
If you were to take an original, what was called a grotesque August clown from the 40s and bring them out today, it would scare a heck of a lot of people.
Huh. Wow.
I mean, the clowns have evolved over the years to the point where a nursing home clown or a hospital clown use very light makeup. In a circus, you have to see somebody from the nosebleed seats. So sure. The makeup has to be big and mm-hmm. and at that time was called grotesque. But the truth of the matter is that it's evolved over the years.
Yeah. I mean, the term circus clown was something we used all the time years ago.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And again, you talked about Bozo before. Bozo was supposed to be in a circus. Circus clowns have a lot to do with this, but there is clowning. Even though you hear about the circus clowns, the clowns that go into hospitals who don't work for pay, mm-hmm. who donate their time, go into nursing homes to donate their time, disasters, donating their time. The Clowns of America International Board is completely, there isn't anyone who gets paid. We all do it because of donating our time.
I can see young people going into clowning and just being ultra creative and coming up with new ways of being a clown, using technology to be a clown.
Evolved. We actually have internet alleys now where you used to meet at Joe's Diner once a month. They now meet online. We used to have our board meetings where we used to have to get together in one spot. We now do that online. The internet has definitely brought everyone together, including clowns.
I can see at one time where there might have been divisions of clowning. I was thinking of mimes. Marcel Marceau, he had makeup on, and the stuff he did was funny.
And again, if you go to different areas, like if you go to Europe, the European clown looks different than the American clown. If you go to Mexico, their makeup is so much more intense. How can I say it? It's evolved over the world in different places, just like other things have evolved differently in different places.
Well, Glenn, I'm a guy who'd like to see clowns as part of our fabric for many years to come. I've seen the joy they bring to faces young and old. What can I do to encourage clown continuation?
I think you're doing that right now. You know, what's wonderful about this article that was written, even though it was incorrectly written, it's gotten a lot of people talking about clowning.
Well, thanks, Glenn, for doing your part to make life a bit more bearable and for providing the kind of innocent fun that defined growing up in America, at least for me and my generation.
And there are many people out there like yourself who really do care about clowning.
Glenn, thanks for being with us on Spectrum West.
Thank you. Take care now.
Be a clown, be a clown. All the world loves a clown. Thanks to head clown Glenn Kohlberger joining us by phone from Florida. And thanks to Lois for providing input on Wisconsin clowns. Did you know we have a clown hall of fame in Baraboo? Yes, we do. Spectrum Memo, don't forget the annual shortest sidewalk parade, Sunday, 11:45 a.m. in Main and Farwell Streets in downtown Eau Claire. Everything culminating at the Acoustic Cafe, the 8th annual St. Patrick's Day fundraiser for WHYS, Wise Community Radio. Music by Barnyard Banshees and the Shillelagh Lads playing there in the background. Food, silent auction, and a bunch more. Saturday evening, it's the Warren Nelson Quartet at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. Tickets, 726-9000, and online at cvca.net. The Chippewa Falls Area School District Art Show is up at the Heidi through Friday, March 21st.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of The Foreigner plays through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. At Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will play Fridays and Saturdays and selected Sundays through August 14th. Aesop's Fables, a production of the Festival Theater's playwriting troupe, will play through Sunday at the theater in St. Croix Falls. The Old Gem Young Performers Ensemble will present Pinkalicious, the musical, for student audiences weekdays through March 20th at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Thank you, sir. His name is Nicholas Butler. That's what his mom calls him, and that's what it says on the cover of his first novel, Shotgun Love Songs. Hope his mom and the publisher don't mind if we call him Nick. He's coming from Eau Claire. That's where he's from. His love for reading was literally born in the Memorial High School library. His love for writing, who knows where that stuff comes from, but in the case of Nick Butler, we're just happy it did. Anyway, since high school, he's followed routes of education, travel, marriage, and fatherhood, and the writing has always been there. And in allowing himself to enjoy it, Nick Butler has become very good at it. So a little more about Nick Butler. Let's talk about you a little bit. How soon in life did you know or think that you had a novel in you?
Very recently. I never saw this as a novel. I wrote short stories before and was very interested in the novella form, but I couldn't conceptualize stringing a story out over 300 pages. I just didn't know how people did that.
How did that happen?
I mean,
you just kept writing and writing and writing?
The thing is, for me, writing a short story, I can sit down at my kitchen table after the kids go to sleep with a cup of coffee, and if things are flowing right, I could do it all in one sitting. I could write a whole short story in one sitting after thinking about it for a long time. Physically, you can't do that with a novel. You can't just, unless you're on drugs or something like that, which for
coffee
some people,
is a form of drug.
Coffee is a good drug too, but... But you can't just keep it coming. And so it just was a matter of time, taking time to let the characters grow and surprise you.
I'm always curious about where ideas for books come from. And I think I'm even more curious about where ideas for first books come from. Do you tend to find that you're working too hard on that book because you know it's your first book and it's got to be really, really good because this is the... This is your debut. This is where people either notice you or they don't. Or do you just write comfortably?
That's a good question.
Did you set out to write a book?
Yes, I did set out to write a book, though. Okay. I thought what this was going to be was loosely connected novellas.
Okay.
They weren't gelling together, right? You know, they were standing alone and not working together. So you have to understand, I think, that I never thought this was ever really going to be published.
Okay.
The odds of getting published are like the odds of getting drafted into the NBA or something. It's not good. I just wrote what I wanted to write. I didn't really have an idea either. I think for me as a writer, things come from emotion, not ideas.
Okay, good.
So I didn't have like a complex plot. There's no aliens. There's no stuff being blown up.
Okay, so then you got to the point where it became a book.
Yes.
How did you know you were at that point?
I was really tired.
I have to put an end to this?
Yeah, I mean, I spent 2 solid years writing the novel, and then about a year of editing it.
Oh, wow.
The summer before the book was sold, my agent and I would pass it back and forth. He would send it to me on a Monday, and I would send it back to him on a Friday. And then he would send it to me on Monday, and I would send it back and forth. We went for months until finally I was just, please let me be done. I can't do it anymore. It's there. It's got to be done. That's why I was done.
Was he convinced of the same?
I think he was satisfied, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So how did you get an agent?
When I got accepted to the Iowa Writers Workshop, that was a big break.
Sure.
Because agents actually come visit us at school. They try and find new clients.
Or so they're recruiting.
They're recruiting. But actually, my agent found me through some short stories that I'd published.
Okay.
And he was the first agent that I trusted. I had the novel all along, or the idea, a couple chapters of it. But I never showed that to anyone because I didn't trust them. And I wanted to make sure that whoever I signed with would sell my collection of short stories first.
Sure.
Before I offered them any idea of a novel.
Nick Butler with us on Spectrum West. The book is Shotgun Love Songs. It's his first, and it's getting some pretty nice reviews. I read words like frank, gut-wrenching, even heartbreaking. Do you set out to be frank, gut-wrenching, and heartbreaking, or is that something that just happens? The other one that I read was deceptively profound. What does that mean? I got to ask Nick what that means. Are you profound in a deceiving way?
I don't know. I don't know if that's a backhanded compliment, too. Like, yeah. I thought this person was simple, but they're not simple. I don't know how to take that. I set off to write a book about the sense of loneliness that I felt for my family and for wanting to return home and for being away from my family. That's all I wanted to do. And kind of explore these set of emotions that I was going through as somebody who is looking around and seeing the first set of divorces. Like, you've been to somebody's wedding and now you're hearing about their divorce. Also, the plot has a lot of weddings in it, and that's because my wife and I had 2 years where we'd gone to 10 or 12 weddings, and that's not even an exaggeration. We'd have to split up some weekend. She'd go to a wedding here and I'd go to one there.
And it's tough when you're attendance at a lot of those.
Yes. I think harder even for women who have to buy a dress that they're maybe never going to wear again.
You should convince women to all wear the same.
A uniform.
All weddings are the
same. A wedding uniform.
All right, so let's let people know where you were, that you were lonely and pining for hometown.
It kind of starts in Madison. My wife was finishing up law school in Madison.
Okay.
She just had her first child. I was working at a liquor store making $8 an hour. We were on food stamps, and we were really close to bankruptcy and foreclosure. And Sam Chang, the director of the Iowa Writers Workshop, called me at the liquor store and offered me a spot at school.
How did you answer the phone?
I was sitting in the back of the liquor store. AC/DC was blaring. I was sitting on kegs of Foster's beer. I remember that.
This is a video.
She said, "Where are you?" And I said, "A liquor store. I work here." So I accepted the offer, and we were going to move to Iowa together as a family.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife got an exceptional job offer in Minneapolis. And no firm in Iowa was going to hire somebody who's the spouse of a workshop person because they know you're only going to be there for 2 years. So we moved our family to Minneapolis, but that meant that I would drive to Iowa every Monday and drive back every Wednesday or Thursday. And while I was living in Iowa City, I rented a room from an adjunct professor, and I had one half of my brother-in-law's childhood bunk bed. I had a small white desk that my mother-in-law lent me, and I had a folding chair, and it was terribly depressing. And also, I felt this huge pressure to succeed because I had a new child. I'd never made any money in my life at all, and I just felt like I can't go back to what I've been doing.
And the most depressing time is the first night you spend in that.
Oh,
I remember the first night I spent in a rooming house in Michigan in my first job. I cried like a baby.
Yeah. Well, and after you've been married for a while, you're used to
I wasn't
being
even married.
Your...
I was single. Maybe I was crying because I was so happy. Well, it's an interesting book. And as you said, it talks about friends and ups and downs. Interestingly enough, it's cool because the chapters don't have numbers. They have initials, and that's what? Is that because it's about that person, or it's that person speaking?
Yeah. Every chapter, where you would find chapter one, for example, in my book you find H, which tells you that it's Henry speaking. I wanted to do that to clarify for the reader who the speaker was exactly.
That's cool. That's a neat twist. You have a neat way of writing. Some of the quotes that I wrote, you're talking about being in a limo, and you say it reoriented itself like a giant compass needle. You use the phrase close, boozy air, corrugated with muscle. I think that was a guy's abs.
Those are my abs, yeah.
All right. The air suddenly perfumed with the sweet aroma of cheap American beer. For some reason, that one had me tearing up. I'm an avid golfer, so the quote, "send the little ball sailing over the countryside towards some small banner over a minor cup in the earth," was kind of tantamount to "it's a good walk spoiled," Twain said, I think, about golfing, wasn't it? Drunk and on a slide to either camaraderie or savage belligerence. And your hairline line, that's a good one, too. My hairline looked almost cowardly, creeping away from my eyebrows.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so now you write as a woman speaking.
Yes.
Is it tough to write as a woman? Did you have to inject womanly things? What's her name?
Beth.
Beth. There's a Chloe in there.
There is a Chloe, yeah. She was originally Claire, but then there's an Eau Claire in the book, and I thought that might be confusing for people. So I don't think there's great differences between men and women. There are differences, but we're all human beings, and I thought about my wife or my mom, and so it became an issue of detail selection. Beth is a mom, so what does she spend her time thinking about, you know, and what are her regrets? Does she wish that she had a job? Does she wish that she had gotten out of Little Wing?
Little Wing is the town that
yes, it is.
Where these people hail from.
Right, and I mean, interestingly, during the process of selling the book, I had talked to at least one, but maybe two different editors who had suggested that I make Beth sound more like a girl, having her use colloquialisms like.
Oh,
and I just thought, that's terrible. My wife doesn't talk like that.
No.
My mom doesn't talk
that's
like that.
That's stereotyping.
Yes. So
I was an editor?
Yeah.
As I was saying, it's getting some nice reviews. Whenever your publisher sends out pre-publicity, those reviews are listed, and many of them are wonderful and glowing. The one that I really like the best, though, is I loved this novel. Everybody who's supposed to give somebody a review, I'm sure that they take great pains to sound intelligent themselves. And yet, this woman, yeah, who is from a bookstore in Athens, Georgia,
all right,
Janet Geddes from Avid Bookshop, I loved this novel. That's all she wrote.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. I'm deeply great. Indebted to independent booksellers all around the country who have gotten behind this book from almost a year ago.
Really? Cool.
Yes. They made it an Indies Introduce, like, debut novel. They made it the independent bookseller's choice from all of March,
wow,
beating out dozens of other titles, and that's all them.
I said that Janet Geddes of the bookshop in Athens, Georgia, that's all she wrote. Let's hope that's not all he wrote. Nick Butler, what's up next? What are you doing? What are you working on?
I have a collection of short stories coming out in 2015, also through St. Martin's Thomas Stone Press. I'm working on a lot of different stuff. The best way I can kind of describe it is when my wife asked me to paint a room. I start in one corner, and then I move to another wall, and then I move to another wall, and my wife walks in 4 hours later and says, "What are you doing? Like, you'd be done by now." But I can't just focus on one thing very well. So I've written some plays that I'm very proud of. I've always written poetry, so I'm doing that. And I'm starting to dabble in the next novel, so...
And you now have to travel some.
A lot of traveling, which is a mixed blessing. It's where a writer wants to be, but it's also tough. I have two small kids. I have a wife that I love a lot, a piece of land that I'm also in love with that I want to spend time on. And
but it's the means.
Yes, that's right.
Towards an end,
yeah,
which is good.
You asked earlier about the pressure to write the first novel, and there's also quite a heavy pressure to write the second one because everyone's waiting at the gate. So I'm just trying to make sure that the next one is in as much as I can help it. I don't want it to be disappointing.
Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
You're a neat
pleasure
guy.
Pleasure to be here.
And I'm looking for bigger and better things from you. And I want you to keep in touch with us here at Spectrum West because we love hanging out with guys like you.
It's not a problem. I'm happy to be here, and I'm a big fan of the show. I listen to it. I don't believe it was around when I was growing up in Eau Claire.
No.
As a lot of things have changed.
Again, way to go.
Thank you, sir.
Nick Butler putting himself on the literary map. By the way, he'll be featured on Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Radio Wednesday, March 26th. In case you'd like to hear more about and from Mr. Butler, he called me sir. At least I can do is call him Mr. Wisconsin Life airs at 6:35 and 8:35 a.m. during morning edition and at 4:45 p.m. on Central Time. On Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Spectrum West. Spectrum Memo, Arms and the Man, a humorous play about the futility of war and the hypocrisies of human nature, hits the stage at UW Barron County today, Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 p.m. Don't forget, Arts West is open at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. 64 pieces, 49 artists on display through April 4th. The Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory features the exhibit The Art of the LP, and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., it's Something for the Wearing of the Green, stories, poems, and songs that commemorate St. Patrick's Day. Northern Gale, a trio of musicians, will celebrate St. Patty's Day Saturday evening, 7:30 at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Details at thephipps.org. Well, when the guest is Mary Logue, you're actually talking to several people at the same time. Jim Oliver is here to assume that role.
Mary Logue writes fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and makes rugs. She has published 9 novels in the Claire Watkins mystery series set in Pepin County. She has also published 2 novels in the Karen Nash series under the name Mary Lou Kerwin. And her novel, Giving Up the Ghost, was serialized last summer in the Star Tribune of Minneapolis. Mary Logue joins us by telephone from her home in the Minneapolis suburbs. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Nice to talk to you again, Tim.
Well, we appreciate your taking the time to visit with us. The latest Claire Watkins book, Lake of Tears, has just been released. And for those rare individuals who may not be acquainted with Claire Watkins, would you give us a mini biography of her and tell us what Lake of Tears is about?
I had written written two standalone mysteries when I introduced myself to Claire Watkins. You know, when you decide to write a series, and that's she was going to be the main character in a series, you have to kind of take care with who this person is, because you're going to have to live a long time with them. So I knew I wanted Claire to have a reason to be looking into criminal investigation. So I made her a deputy sheriff. I had just bought a house in Stockholm, Wisconsin, and was madly in love with the landscape and the community. So I knew that that's where she was going to be centered. She had lived in Minneapolis, and I moved her to the Pepin County area because I wanted her to also be a stranger, a foreigner to the area, because I was. And there was a lot about living in a small community. Pepin County is the smallest county in Wisconsin, and there was a lot about life there that was new to me, and I wanted it to be new to Claire. Now, I have to say, going to Lake of Tears, which, as you said, is the ninth book, so Claire's been living in Pepin County now for, I don't know, 15, 20 years, somewhat, something like that. And she certainly is much more familiar and feels like it is her place. When I started writing this series, I found out early on in doing some of my historical research that Lake Pepin was named Lake of Tears by Father Hennepin when he was captured by the Lakota Sioux and held captive on the shores of Lake Pepin. So I always knew I wanted to use that as the title of a book. For me, it seems to work especially well with this book because I'm also dealing with the Afghanistan war and returning war veterans. And so that whole notion of the warrior really comes through, I think, with the title also, if you know the historic background of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in earlier conversations we've had, you said you had most identified personally with Claire's daughter, Meg, rather than with Claire herself. In Lake of Tears, Meg has turned 18 and is getting ready to head off to college. Is there anything autobiographical about her rite of passage?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I think there is. I think that I wrote the very end, and I won't give anything away particularly, and in fact, even talking about the very, very end of this book would not give anything away, but the relationship at that time between Claire and her daughter Meg is not unlike my relationship with my mother. I was very lucky. I had a wonderful woman as a mother, and we really not only deeply loved each other, but were extremely fond of each other.
Oh, that's an interesting combination.
And so the last scene in the book when Meg is driving off is kind of reminiscent of how it felt for me, and I assume felt for my mother when I left home for that first time.
Well, some of your characters suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. What did you learn about PTSD and working on the book?
Yeah, I did do a lot of research on it, and I don't mean to defend the Veterans Administration and how they're dealing with PTSD, but I will say this, that I think it's a difficult thing to deal with. It carries a lot of shame. A lot of men especially are ashamed and scared when they come home to admit that there's anything wrong. You know, it isn't only, obviously, soldiers that have this. It is anyone that's gone through a traumatic incident. I have two war veterans in this book. I think both of them suffer from it, one not so badly and the other one quite badly. I guess I wanted to kind of show the scope of it. And again, I do think, you know, Claire in an early, much, much earlier book goes into therapy and has to deal with her own traumatic incident. So again, I think she is pretty compassionate about what that can be like.
As I recall, and the reason she moved there in the first place is her first husband had been shot and killed, and he was a policeman. Is that stretching my memory here?
I don't think he... No, I don't remember. I don't think he was the cop himself, but he was shot as a result of an investigation she was working on.
Ah. Well, let's move on to Death Overdue. Tell us about Karen Nash and what's she up to this time? Now we're switching to Mary Lou Kerwin all of a sudden.
Yes, yes. Okay, now I'll put my other hat on. Karen's a librarian, and she is from a little town called Sunshine Valley that has a lot in common with Golden Valley in Minneapolis. In the first book, she goes off her first journey to England, both kind of heartbroken because her boyfriend has broken up with her, and they were supposed to go on the trip together, and also full of joy. Odd how those emotions can sometimes be in us at the same time, because she's a real bibliophile, and she's particularly an Anglophile also, loves all the British writers, and so is really overjoyed to be going there. In this book, she's going back, and she has a big decision to make. She's fallen in love with a wonderful man, Caldwell, who ran the B&B she stayed in, and who also, like her, is very much a lover of books.
She is Mary Logue, the author of the Clara Watkins mystery series set in Pepin County, writes also under the name of Mary Lou Kerwin, and has just published the novel Death Overdue. Did you spend some time in London to get a feel for the atmosphere there?
Yes, I'm very lucky. I lived in France when I was a little pumpkin, when I was about 21 years old, and I lived with British students for a year. My very good friend, whose name happens to be Janet Nash, and I have stayed in very close touch for, yay, these many 40 years. So I have been lucky enough to have a place to stay in London. Also, I have had a wonderful person who can vet my book before it comes out, so I don't make any horrible British mistake.
Uh-huh. What does the future hold for these two series?
If and when I do another Karen Nash book, I do think I would bring it back home. You know, we've had little inklings of Sunshine Valley, but I feel like if Caldwell and Karen are going to make a go of it, it's time for him to spend a little time in the United States. And as far as Claire goes, there is a very slight chance that Lake of Tears might be the last book. I'm really up in the air about that. But if I do write another Claire, it will be about this frack sand mining that's happening all along the river, because that has been a very explosive subject and is directly affecting Pepin County. Again, I often feel like I owe something to my community to write about what's going on there, really.
Moving on, then, to another book. Giving Up the Ghost was the story that the newspaper turned back the clock to serialize. Will it ever appear in book form?
I hope so. I think so. It's available on Kindle or on e-books now. And I actually did, believe it or not, save all of the papers. And I had this notion that I would put them together in kind of a loose leaf binder. I don't know if I'll get to that. But at some point, I'll get the rights to the book back. And then I'm thinking I would like to bring it out as a regular book.
I can remember. I'm old enough to remember when actually newspapers did serialize novels. I wasn't a big fan of them then, nor am I now. I'm in the process of reading it. I have downloaded it to my Nook. It's a good read, so I think that probably would go well as a real book, as they say.
You mean How Did It Happen?
How Did It Happen, yeah.
Well, you know, I think newspapers, like publishers, are looking for more ways to get more readership happening. I think we're all scrambling a little bit and not sure exactly, you know, where computers are going to end and where publishing is going to start. And this seemed like a kind of a fun way to try something that, like you say, has been done before but hasn't been done very recently. And I had this novel that actually really worked well for this serialization because of the way I had written it, which is fairly short chapters with lots of little breaks. There's really two times that are being written about in this book, and she kind of skips back and forth. So it actually really lent itself to having a shorter section of it available every day. The thing that was funny for me when it was coming out was that people literally would stop me in the grocery store and say, "Is the cat going to be okay?"
Anyway, what's the premise of the book?
Or, Giving Up the Ghost?
Yeah.
I always wanted to write a ghost story. I'm also very intrigued by books where you're not really sure if it's someone's imagination or if it's really happening. So that was something I really wanted to play with in this book. I also really wanted to write about the kind of scene in the Twin Cities, art scene. You know, I went to the New French Cafe a lot when I was in my 30s and 40s, and there was a really thriving art scene in the Twin Cities that I felt like I really wanted to explore. And so the main character is a woman whose husband has just died, and she can't seem to leave their cabin up north to come back to the cities and really to come back to life.
Seems to me that I've missed a book of poetry somewhere along the line here.
I'm happy to say it was a book I did in collaboration with my sister, Dodie Logue, and it's called Trees. It was very serendipitous. We were talking one day, and Dodie was doing these gorgeous charcoal drawings of trees, and I realized I had written a lot of poems about trees. So we decided to collaborate, and it's 16 of my poems and 16 of her charcoal drawings. We published it ourselves, and it's kind of a lovely art book. I'm just really thrilled with it.
And finally, I have to ask you about your rug hooking.
I'm leaving in a few weeks to go to Guatemala to rug hook with a group of Mayan women who have learned how to rug hook, and I'm really interested in watching their design process, and I hope maybe I can teach them something from how I do it.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, we've been visiting with Mary Logue, who is author of Lake of Tears, the latest in her Claire Watkins series, Death Overdue, the second in the Karen Nash series, written under the pen name of Mary Lou Kerwin, and Giving Up the Ghost, which was serialized last summer in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Lake of Tears and Death Overdue are available from most booksellers and from online sites. Giving Up the Ghost is an ebook. And refresh my memory, the name of your book of poetry is?
It's Trees. And you'd have to go to my website or my sister's to get that.
Okay. Well, Mary Logue, thank you for being kind enough to join us and putting up with my bumbling around here. And best wishes on the book and on your art, and enjoy Guatemala.
I will. Thanks so much, Jim.
And thank you both. Final Spectrum Memo, the exhibit Imagining Otherness, Catching Sight of Monstrosity, opens Friday and will be up through April 25th in the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Well, here's a reminder. This program is repeated at 7 p.m. Friday on the News and Classical Music Network stations in West Wisconsin, namely 89.7 and 90.7 on your FM receiver. It's also archived at the Wisconsin Public Radio website, that is WPR.org, www.wpr.org. Coming up next week on Spectrum West, a new musical western from Jerry Way gets ready to open in Triple Falls. Community Theater in Amory takes the stage. We're going to go behind the scenes at Antiques Roadshow and more. Of course, always more on Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. I'll see you next week.